Because we seek to emphasize the virtue in our own stories, we end up editing out, very often, essential features of history. And that's what this book is about, restoring these essential features to our understanding of where we are today and how we got here.
I'm Raj Kumar, and you're in the DevEx Book Club. Maybe you're a global development nerd like me. Maybe you work at the UN or an NGO. Or maybe you're just excited to hear from some of the world's leading authors on the most important issues of the day. Either way, you're in the right place. Grab a snack, get a comfortable seat, and don't worry if you haven't read the book, you're very much welcome. Get ready for our discussion. This month's book club author is Howard French. In the field of international affairs reporting, you don't get much more successful than Howard. His resume is the stuff of childhood dreams. He's held posts as the New York Times bureau chief in Central America and the Caribbean, West and Central Africa, Japan and the Koreas, and China. And his bylines have appeared in The Atlantic, The New York Review of Books, The New York Times Magazine, and many others. Howard is also the author of numerous books, the most recent of which is Born in Blackness, Africa, Africans, and the Making of the Modern World, 1471 to the Second World War. Born in Blackness covers a lot of ground, 6 centuries of history, and a near complete reframing of the narrative around how the modern world came to be. I'm thrilled to have Howard here today to discuss why he wrote a book like this and the effect it's had on how we think about Africa and its place in history. Howard, it is such a great pleasure to get to talk with you. I, of course, have known of you, have read your work in the past, and to get a chance to discuss with you your book, Born in Blackness, is a great pleasure and an honor. Really nice to be with you.
Wonderful to be with you too, Raj.
You know, what's amazing about this book, it's in many ways a culmination of your whole career as a journalist, as an author, and kind of piecing together, really in an incredibly ambitious way, almost an alternative view of modern history. And it pains me to even call it an alternative view, because in many ways, I think it's the, as you demonstrate well in this book, it is the accurate view of modern history, but different than the one many of us have been taught and told, especially in Western societies, for so many years because of sort of the political nature of history. And so you set out on this very ambitious task to tell a different story that really puts Africa and its people in many ways at the center of modern history. I want to obviously hear a lot more about that, and I have a lot of things from the book that I want to ask you about. But maybe we could just start with a little bit about you and your own personal story. You get into it in the book as well, your family history, kind of how that may have connected you to this story in a very personal way.
Thank you. So you've anticipated part of the answer, which is that my career as a longtime correspondent for the New York Times overseas, and as prior to that, as a freelancer for the Washington Post and for various other publications, at the very outset of my work as a journalist, took me all over the Atlantic Basin, right? I worked in 2 different periods of my life in West and Central Africa, and also covered much of the rest of the continent. I'm from Washington, D.C., which is actually part of, most people don't think of this anymore, but it's part of the American South. I speak several European languages and have done some brief stints as a journalist in Europe, and I've covered the Caribbean Basin and parts of South America as well. And so that's the first leg in a sort of tripod, I would call it, in terms of what leads to this book. That is the world of transatlantic slavery, in short, right? And I didn't start out 25, I mean, I've been deeply aware of transatlantic slavery for my whole life, and that's part of the second leg, which I'll come to. But this didn't start out as some kind of organic notion in my head. I just was bathing in this for professional reasons because of the background I've just described to you. So the second leg is the personal in a kind of family sense. I said I grew up in Washington, D.C. My mother's family is from there and from nearby Virginia, ancestrally. And on my mother's side of the family, we are descendants of a friend of Thomas Jefferson's, who had children by a woman he owned, much like Thomas Jefferson did. That's my grandmother's grandmother. And so I grew up very much, this is something I, like earliest tales of family, I knew about this as a boy before I had any notion about big picture history or anything like that. It was in the back of my head. It was dinner table conversation. And more than that, even because my family inherited, my generation inherited via that long line of succession through a really remarkable story, some land that enslaved African Americans from the Thomas Jefferson era had managed to come to take possession of during Reconstruction. And that it's not a huge amount of land, but it's very valuable in terms of legacy and in terms of my sense of who I am and my family's sense of itself, right? And so slavery has been a big thing for me, not as a kind of political cause so much as just a matter of a fact of life. It's been an integral part of my background and my notion of who I am.
Yeah, you tell, Howard, you tell a story in the book that's fascinating, right at the very end in your acknowledgement section, about visiting Thomas Jefferson's home, Monticello, with your mother, and the questions she would pepper the guides with, much to their chagrin. Maybe you could just share a little bit about that story and connect it to what you're talking about.
Yeah, so this goes, I've never really thought of this answer this way, but this goes to what you said in your very opening remarks about the book. When you said it's sort of taking on the conventional views of history, I got some of this from my mother, and it comes through in the very question or the answer to the question that you asked. My mother would take us to Monticello when we were kids every once in a while, and she, because she knew so much about our own history, she had reasons to be really, really skeptical of the official history of Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, the black woman whom he owned and produced children by, right? And this was at a time when, you know, the Sally Hemings Jefferson story was kind of brooded about sotto voce, whispered between people, but never given much official credence or space in the legendary stories of Thomas Jefferson that we all grew up learning, right? So my mother knew the whispered accounts, and she knew our background, and therefore had reason to really be more than suspicious, to believe that Thomas Jefferson actually fathered children by that woman, and this was being erased in the official guide. And then, so that was in my boyhood, and then I guess in my young adulthood, through a variety of processes, really great Annette Gordon Reed's fantastic historical writing about Thomas Jefferson, plus DNA investigations, validated the notion that this was, in fact, his family, Jefferson's family. And so now this has become incorporated, finally, in even in the guidebook or tour guide kind of experience of Monticello.
Yeah, it's interesting. We're going through in the United States, and I think in Europe as well, to a degree, maybe more so in the U.S. right now, but we're going through kind of a historical reckoning. And maybe we're in the backlash phase of that reckoning now, where it's become very animating, especially for some right-leaning politicians in the U.S. to kind of push back on this alternate history that you and others have been promoting. And it's amazing because we're talking about things from hundreds of years ago. I mean, your book begins in the 14th century, and yet it's so current. It's so immediate. It really feels that way. Even this is a book of history, but it doesn't feel like something disconnected from today. And in fact, I had my own kind of personal connection to your book in that right at the outset and a few times throughout, you mention, you know, one of the most quintessential moments in the conventional history of the world, which is Vasco da Gama going around the Cape of Good Hope, around the African continent, and landing in a small place called Calicut in India. And that's actually where my family's from. My dad was born in Calicut. And so I've always, as a kid, grown up, you know, a little bit similar to your story, hearing about Calicut, reading the name Vasco da Gama, and hearing this idea that really it was the spices and the silks from India and from China that was propelling the Europeans to want to get there, And that was kind of this moment of globalization and world trade. And one of the things you right at the outset kind of put a stake in is to say, well, that's wrong. That they weren't just going around Africa. Africa played a central role in the early shaping of a modern world. Maybe you could just talk a little bit about that point.
Sure. That brings me to the third pillar in my stool, or tripod. I was a correspondent in East Asia in the latter half of my career for the New York Times overseas. And prior to this book, my previous two books were about China. And the most immediate prior book was a book really about my first true work of history. It's called Everything Under the Heavens, and I was exploring the roots of China's notions of itself as a world power. And this also spanned a very long period of time, because China has such a long imperial history. In fact, much longer, that book covers a much longer time span than the present book does. But as I researched that book, spending lots of times in libraries and archives, I quite accidentally came into an awareness, or became aware of, Portuguese accounts of their maritime explorations in the 15th century. And these explorations left me completely dumbstruck, because we are taught precisely what you just said, and that is that Africa was simply an empty space. It was a terra nullius. It was something, an obstacle that needed to be gotten around in order to get to India and eventually to China, and that's what the age of exploration was all about, and it was not about anything else. And so I wasn't looking for what I found. When I find these accounts in Portuguese, actually, of the Portuguese explorers spending decades in the 15th century, first of all, in pursuit of wealth in Africa, which is an important thought. They didn't start out thinking Africa was unimportant at all. In fact, they started out with an obsession with finding gold in Africa, and then spending decades dwelling in Africa, building political ties, diplomatic relations, religious ties with various places in Africa, important ones, naming African bishops, the Vatican did. Prior to ever reaching Calicut or East Asia, I thought, oh, this is a book. I have to write this. This runs so contrary to everything we learn, all of us, about the start of the modern age or of modernity and where we all come from and what has brought us together in a conversation like this or in our everyday lives, whatever we do.
Yeah, the narrative is just so different, you know, and it permeates all the way to the present day. But maybe just staying back in history for a moment before we come closer to the present. You know, in that period that you just described, Mali played a particularly important role. And you even talk about an individual, Mansa Musa. Maybe you could just tell us a little bit about him as a way to illustrate a bit of what you just began to describe.
Sure. So it starts with a predecessor of Mansa Musa named Abubakar II, who was an emperor of a polity called the Mali Empire, which is occupied a vast space in the sort of sub-Saharan bulge of West Africa, not along the coast, but the interior sub-Saharan zone, which is we call today the Sahel. And the Mali Empire was the successor of another empire in roughly the same geographic space called the Ghana Empire. And Ghana, starting around the year 1000, rose as a gold power. Most of Ghana sat astride the great gold trade routes of Africa and the mines that are located in places like northern Guinea, today's nation state called Guinea. And so Ghana was the source of most of the gold entering Europe starting 1,000 years ago. Ghana falls, Mali rises in the same rough space. And in 1306 or thereabouts, an emperor of Mali named Abubakar II gets into his mind the thought, what if we tried to discover if there's other, I don't think he would have used the word continent, right? But that's what we can use that word. What if we were able to discover another continent on the far side of the great ocean that is on our shores? That ocean is, of course, the Atlantic. Abubakar II mounted two expeditions to try to cross the ocean, laden with lots of gold, to try to establish gold trade, that was their product, with whatever they could find on the far side of the ocean. And so in the very beginning of this book, I describe what I think his motivations must have been. By the way, this is not speculative. This is written in contemporaneous documents, which I will explain to you in a moment, right? And so Abubakar II dies in the second expedition. He sets out at sea at the head of many long, elaborate dugout boats and is never seen again. So it's almost certain that he was lost at sea. His successor, Mansa Musa, then says, let's try something else. Let me mount a giant expedition to Mecca via Cairo, carrying lots of gold, and sort of announce Mali's presence on the world stage that way. What was the motivation that I think linked these two great ambitious pursuits? It was trying to organize an end run around Berber control of the gold trade into Europe. So the Berbers were the people who dominated in places like Morocco and Algeria, and all of the Malian, and prior to that, Ghana gold had to pass through their hands. And so Mali was looking for a way to cut out the middleman and to make much more profit from its gold. First, let's find another continent. Second, let's do an end run around the Berbers through Cairo. We can make more money. We won't have to surrender so much of our profit to other people, right? Mansa Musa, in 1326, arrives in Cairo carrying 18 tons of gold, an enormous cortege of people on camel and horseback, donkey and mule, whatever. And he distributes all of the gold in acts of patronage, just gives it away to religious authorities, to mosques, to local governors, to, you know, kings here and there, and finally in Cairo to the rulers of the Mamluk Empire. Those are the people who write these two accounts. They take an oral history from Mansa Musa of the lineage of his empire, and they learn the story of Abu Bakr II, and they also learn, of course, about Mansa Musa himself. This lights a fire in the imagination of Europeans, and it creates the spark that sets off the Age of Discovery, starting in the early 1400s, and led principally by the Portuguese, who were an upstart kingdom in Iberia, who had broken away from what I'll call proto-Spain, right? Castile and Aragon and places like that. The Portuguese said, we don't want to be part of your politics. We're going to start our own kingdom, the Aviz dynasty. And they were very poor and weak, and they didn't have a window on the Mediterranean, which is the normal way that Iberian kingdoms had been able to acquire wealth through trade. All the Portuguese had was a window on the Atlantic. And so they said, let's explore the Atlantic. And since we know about this, the tale of this guy, Mansa Musa, maps started to be drawn. Portraits of this black king started to be drawn, Mansa Musa. And the Portuguese determined that this should be their national priority, is of finding this guy or his empire and establishing political relations and trade with him for gold, that would be their secret sauce. And so this beginning in the 1420s and 1430s becomes literally the Apollo program of the Aviz dynasty. This is their moonshot that we'll finally be able to stand up against Spain if we can do this. And over the course of decades, because of the limits of Portuguese and European in general, sailing technology and navigational skills and various other things, they slowly make their way down the coast around the bulge of West Africa, looking for Mali, looking for some way to get to the interior of that part of Africa to find the source of this enormous supply of gold. And this culminates in 1472 when they arrive in what is modern-day Ghana, which is not the same thing as the Ghana Empire we talked about earlier. Coastal West Africa, it's not Mali either, but lo and behold, there's an enormous amount of gold available to trade there. And so this is how Portugal becomes a naval power in the world. This is the trading with that part of West Africa, modern-day Ghana, quickly becomes the most important source of wealth of the Aviz dynasty. They name their treasury, which is in the imperial palace of the Aviz, the House of Africa. The literal name was House of Guinea. Guinea was their word for Black Africa. They renamed the treasury House of Africa because that's how important the gold trade of that part of the world had suddenly become for them. So this is in the middle to late parts of the 15th century. And for the rest of that century, the Portuguese priority was not rushing onward to Asia, to Calicut, or to China, but to establishing and to deepening ties with all of the rest of Africa and pursuing, I'm sorry for the long answer, but pursuing a theory of the distribution of gold that is kind of funny when we think back about it now. But you can understand, they thought if so much gold is in this latitude of the world, that must mean that gold is distributed latitudinally. in the world. So gold must be found wherever it's found. It must be found in greatest quantity 5-10 degrees north and south of the equator. And that is precisely where sub-Saharan Africa, the center of sub-Saharan Africa. And so that was the main zone of exploration for the Europeans. The Spanish followed the Portuguese, others, the French, eventually the English followed them. That was the main area of concentration prior even to Calicut or to Malacca or to East Asia.
So the book, as you just described, begins with this idea that wealth in that era was seen as synonymous with gold. Gold was a key source of wealth for those early European empires. But then very quickly, there's a transition to seeing slavery, black Africans held in bondage, as not even close to the wealth that gold can provide, something at a totally different scale. And obviously it creates an entirely new global economy built around the slave trade and around the slaves themselves and the work that they do, thinking about things like sugar that you talk a lot about and cotton that you also talk a lot about. Maybe you could just describe a little bit about that history and how it's a bit different than the way we're conventionally taught.
Sure. Well, so you've cast this very well. What happens is that while Portugal is leading this European pursuit of trade and of wealth in Africa, they make an accidental discovery. They are pursuing this theory of the geographic distribution of gold, a little bit north and a little bit south of the equator, and they discover a tiny unoccupied island, which we call today Sao Tome, which they named Sao Tome. And this is one of the great kind of accident/coincidences of history. Some Portuguese sailor had aboard his ship shoots of sugarcane. Sugarcane was a crop that was just beginning to be experimented with in southern Europe, in places like the Canary Islands and Madeira, far to the north of the equator in the Atlantic Ocean. Henry the Navigator, the Portuguese prince, and various other people had begun to experiment with the commercial production of sugar, which was an incredibly expensive luxury item back then. We're talking about refined white sugar, right? Sugar was not a big part of the European diet yet. It was a rare thing. And so Henry the Navigator, who led, by the way, the pursuit of these contacts with Africa for the discovery of gold, also led farther to the north in the Atlantic, the development of the early sugar industry, right? Somebody on one of these ships, early ships reaching Sao Tome, was carrying sugarcane cuttings and planted them in Sao Tome and boom, discovered that unlike the Canary Islands or Madeira, which have drier, much more temperate climates, near the equator in this volcanic island where you have heavy seasonal rains and very rich soils, sugarcane grows like a miracle crop. I mean, again, the accounts from that time, people describe you being able to see the plants grow from day to day. And so this sets off the creation of the most important transformative industry in the early modern history of the world. And that industry is sugar. And along with this industry is born the most transformative and important economic institution of the early modern period and long afterwards. And that institution is what I call the prison industrial slave camp. This is what Americans call plantations. It is a quasi-industrial production of sugar using enslaved people in labor camps, right? I don't like plantation because I think it takes us away from our understanding really of what's going on here. And it does all of these things through the use of yet another paradigmatic change in human relations. It enslaves people for the first time on a large scale in human history on the exclusive basis of race. And a whole ideology emerges around this, in which the Catholic Church plays a very big part. And that ideology legitimates the enslavement of Africans. And this institution, the shorthand name of this institution is chattel. That chattel comes to mean Africans, black Africans come to be understood and legitimated through religion and ideology as chattel. Chattel, to help your listeners understand better, comes from the same root in Latin as cattle. That these are not human beings, shall not be considered in the same way that we consider other human beings. These are desocialized people, quasi-animals, right? They, by the way, chattel has the same root as cattle, but also of capital. And so these human beings, these quasi-humans, these dehumanized people, become movable capital. They're tradable capital. They're like cattle. You can trade, you can breed, you can slaughter cattle without any uncomfortable sort of sense of guilt, right? And so all of these things arise at the same time together and are born right there on this tiny little island located just maybe a degree north of the equator called Sao Tome. Sugar takes off explosively there. And then comes another incredible accident.
Are you interested in the intersection of business and social impact? Do you want to know how corporate sustainability, ESG, impact investing, and more can contribute to development finance? My name is Adva Saldinger. I'm a senior reporter at DevEx, and I've been reporting on these issues for nearly a decade. I'm the author of DevEx Invested, our free weekly newsletter dedicated to development finance. Every Tuesday, we explore how companies, investors, and market mechanisms are reshaping the world of development finance. Visit devx.com/newsletters and join us on Tuesdays.
The Portuguese, as we've already established, are not rushing onward to Asia yet. We're talking now in the 1470s, 1480s. They are experimenting with navigational techniques to try to hasten their exploration of Africa. And the navigational technique they are trying out, first proven by the Arabs, is tacking, which means cutting east and west in larger and larger triangles in order to go faster in a north-south direction. In other words, rather than hugging the coast of Africa, Africa being an extremely large continent, they go east-west in these big triangles, and they can make progress down the coast faster that way. In this process, the Portuguese discover, quote-unquote, Brazil. They bump into Brazil. They were not, unlike Columbus, who has not entered yet into our conversation, I should say, they were not looking for Brazil. They were looking for ways to explore Africa more quickly, and boom, they bump into Brazil, and now another big moment arrives. Brazil, very similar climate to Sao Tome. Unlike Sao Tome, it's not a tiny little geographic space. It's a quasi-continent. And so sugar and the techniques that had been perfected of growing, producing sugar commercially in this prison industrial labor camp system through the employment of chattel is transferred across the Atlantic, and Brazil quickly takes off for the Portuguese and becomes the main basis of their wealth. And this is where sugar and slavery, these conjoined phenomena, begins to quickly surpass gold. In fact, I make the point in the book that Portugal, beginning in the 1570s, 80s, by which time the Africans had totally replaced Native Americans as the source of labor for the Portuguese in Brazil, the sugar from Brazil becomes more valuable than all of the gold and silver that Spain acquired through the conquest of various kingdoms in the Americas. Now, we all know those stories. We all learn, if you've had any education in world history at all, you learn the stories of the conquest, of a version of the stories of the conquest of the Aztecs and the Incas, and these people like Pizarro who ride up into the mountains with very small groups of valiant soldiers, and they sack these enormous empires and take away all of their gold in these fat-bellied galleons, and now Spain is suddenly rich, right? What we don't learn is that through chattel and prison industrial labor camp systems and the production of this new, incredibly profitable commodity called sugar, Portugal is actually making more money, and the processes that it is using to do so are much more influential in the terms of the course of human history than the sacking of people for the simple carting away of gold could have ever been.
And I think one fact that you mention in the book that underlines that is the enormous wealth of these tiny islands in the Caribbean and how important they were to the British Empire, to the Portuguese, to the Spanish and others. Maybe you could say a word about that. You mentioned Barbados as an example. You know, not a place you think of as having, you know, a big Incan dynasty or Aztec dynasty with all of its wealth and gold, but yet ends up becoming so vital to the British Empire.
Right. So the British and the French, who become preeminent imperial powers, you know, 200 years later, are in the period we're talking about, in the 1500s. They're nowhere. they're not even on the map, really. Like, they're laggards, almost pitiful. And they're watching Spain and Portugal through the very different processes of these two powers, acquiring enormous wealth and trying to figure out, how do we do that? What can we do? How do we catch up? And Spain had invested in naval expansions to such an extent and was bellicose, right? England couldn't really afford to take on Spain frontally. Spain controlled all of the big islands in the Caribbean. Cuba, Hispaniola, Jamaica. We don't think of Jamaica as being Spanish, but Jamaica was Spanish. Puerto Rico, all of the big islands were Spanish, right? The English said, look, the Portuguese are making this incredible amount of money in sugar. What if we could find a place where we could also develop sugar? And so they went to what we call the Lesser Antilles, which are the much smaller islands that extend south in the Caribbean toward the South American continent. Barbados is the most important example of these. The English arrive in Barbados in 1630. It's also at that time, much like Sao Tome had been, unoccupied. And the English lay claim to Barbados. The Spanish couldn't care less. They have these gigantic islands a few hundred miles to the north, and they're making money from them, and it didn't seem like anything to worry about. So the English import Dutch people who were running Portuguese slave plantations in Brazil, and they import enslaved Africans from Brazil who were experts in various aspects of the complicated machinery of producing sugar commercially. They import these people from Brazil to teach them how to grow sugar commercially in Barbados. That begins in 1630, and by the middle of that century, Africans had completely replaced indentured servants from Europe as the main source of labor in Barbados. And by the latter half of that century, sugar wealth from Barbados becomes the most important source of income for England. This is the beginning of Imperial England. British people do not learn their history this way. British people focus on India as, you know, their great imperial story. And I understand. India became very important to British history, obviously, right? But that was much later. That was considerably later before India becomes economically important to England. And we can get into the reasons why countries choose to have certain kinds of emphases for the start of their glorious moments, right? But the English copied the Portuguese in Brazil using Dutch experts. And in Little Barbados, which is one-third the size of the city of Los Angeles and one-sixth the size of Long Island, if you know what Long Island off of New York City looks like, they end up importing 400,000 people from Africa to work in sugar on Barbados over the years, essentially through a planned grinding out of human lives. This was a simple, calculated fact of business, right? That we'll bring Africans in. They will survive on average in this brutal work of sugar cultivation between 5 and 7 years, I think, for Barbados. In the beginning, it was actually 5 years. And we just have to keep replacing in that rhythm. We're going to burn them out, which means kill them and just keep replacing them. This is just a normal feature of business. In the second half of the 17th century, this was England's biggest game in terms of getting started as an empire. And they acquired so much wealth then and so quickly that they were able to begin building a navy, a navy that could operate on the far side of the Atlantic and challenge and eventually defeat Spain in naval theaters in the Western Hemisphere. And so the English take over Jamaica, much bigger island, by defeating the Spanish, and then implant the sugar industry in Jamaica. Jamaica is much bigger than Barbados, and this is really the takeoff of Britain as England becomes Britain in 1707, the takeoff of Britain as a world power. The English do not learn their history this way at all. There is nothing speculative about any of this. The years, the dates, the conquests, the economic impacts, the income from sugar, the number of slaves, all of these things are very clearly established. But the English don't care to speak about this as the foundation of their rise for what I think are very human reasons. Listen, I'm sitting in New York City. I'm an American, right? Many of your listeners are American. Americans don't speak of their rise either on the basis of the enslavement of people from Africa. People everywhere seek to focus their successes, the stories of their successes, on virtuous things, on things that they think are sound virtuous or seem virtuous. And enslaving other people and working them to death is the opposite of that.
That's right. I think the most of the narrative, and again, not just in England or the US, but I think about the Netherlands and Spain and Portugal, I mean, all the wealthy countries of the world today, you know, aside from some of the newer wealthy countries, but generally they think of themselves as having a lot of ingenuity, that they invented something. There was a technology, there was, you know, we had the most adventurous maritime people in our country, and we invented a new kind of ship or a new kind of weapon or a new way of navigating. And, you know, there's a lot of ingenuity, I think, in the narrative that passes down among countries that have succeeded. And you tell the story of kind of the numbers, right? The awful math of this institution of slavery, that it was some 12 million people who were brought over as slaves. Maybe 10% died on the way, and another 6 million died in the process. So when you think of the scale of this, and you compare it to the relatively small size of the population at the moment, I think you mentioned that the overall population of Africa this time was about 100 million people. So you think of the scale of this, then in a way it's no wonder that actually the wealth of all of these now powerful countries was built on this institution and slavery not just being something sort of marginal used by farmers. You know, as you say, the word plantation, it sounds so quaint, and what you're describing really is a massive commercial enterprise. You had one number in the book that stood out to me where you talk about, and I can't remember the precise figures, but you talk about how a slave on a cotton plantation was producing, I'm going to make it up, but some tens of pounds of cotton a day. And then they perfected the system to such a degree that an individual slave would produce 341 pounds of cotton per day. And I was trying to just get my head around the scale of that and how you could do it. And that's the technology, right? That's the ingenuity. It was essentially this awful use of human beings in this way as almost like machine parts in this massive global factory.
Again, you've said this very well. I mean, I wish I had thought of this notion of machine parts, because that really captures it. But to return to this word of ingenuity, I also sometimes use the word virtue. We look for virtuous explanations of our success, finding virtue in ourselves as individuals and as nations to explain our successes. I think this is universal, right? And so the Industrial Revolution, which is, you know, Britain's perhaps biggest contribution to economic history, right, is described in virtuous terms, in terms of genius, that some people in the Lancashire region of that country figured out how to organize labor and used some new technologies and pulled this all together, looms under one roof with management, and, you know, people figure out supply and sequencing of various operations. Next thing you know, you have a globally dominant textile industry, right? It sounds wonderful. Where did the cotton come from? How did you get such an incredible, and the numbers are incredible, how did you get such an incredible increase in textile production? Did the cotton come from the clouds? Did it just descend or arrive like on robot ships from some unknown destination? No, it arrived mostly from the Mississippi River Valley, where in the early 19th century, the United States had transferred a tremendous number of its enslaved people of African descent out of the so-called Old South westward for the production of cotton, right? And as you said in the beginning of your remark, the productivity of enslaved people of African descent had to be just as remarkable. The increasing productivity of those people in enslavement had to be just as remarkable. In fact, they had to be in tandem as the increase of productivity of the people in Lancashire working in looms and textile factories that we celebrate as the sort of genius of the Industrial Revolution. But in celebrating that genius, we have cut the ugly part out of the picture, entirely out of the picture. And by the way, this isn't just an English or British story, right? This is also the story of America's rise. Cotton was, in the era we're talking about, of these tremendous productivity increases in terms of eking cotton out of the the sweat and blood of people of African descent in the Mississippi River Valley, cotton was, by a very, very long distance, the most important export product of the United States. It was the only product of the United States that the world couldn't do without in that era. It was a preponderant factor in the rise of the United States economically in the first half of the 19th century. We simply don't learn about it that way. This is not a polemical notion, right? Nobody has actually objected to the statement of facts around this subject in my book ever, right? However, because we like to talk of ourselves, and I do wish to emphasize this is universal. I don't think this is something only Europeans do or only white people do or only people from country or place X, Y, or Z do. I really think of this as universal. Because we seek to emphasize the virtue in our own stories, we end up editing out very often essential features of history. And that's what this book is about, restoring these essential features to our understanding of where we are today and how we got here.
I'm racing you through hundreds of years of history, but I want to kind of go past where the book ends, because I'm thinking about your career and all the reporting you've done. I'm thinking about our audience at DevEx and their interest in global development. And there's sort of two sides to the coin. We talked about one side being the richest countries in the world today, by and large, are countries that got rich on the back of slavery. But the poorest countries in the world today, by and large, are the countries from which these slaves came. And many of the places you've mentioned already, both in West Africa, the Sahel, but also thinking about Haiti as an example that was also mentioned, you know, once one of the richest countries in the world and most influential countries in the world, as you say in your book. How has reporting and researching this history changed, if at all, your own conception? Or what is your conception about global development today as kind of an enterprise, you know, that we're trying to change the fortunes of these countries that are at the very bottom of the economic pyramid and got there, as your book suggests, for a reason? How does it affect sort of your worldview about this enterprise of global development?
Well, it's a very complicated question, and I'm working on a new book project now, actually, hopefully soon to be finished, that picks up where this book ends. The subtitle of this book is, it uses the temporal period from 1471, when gold was discovered in Ghana, to the Second World War. The next book picks up at the Second World War and treats the vast topic of the independence era, especially in Africa, as a neglected feature of our understanding of world history. So how did the independence of colonized countries come about, and what has this meant in terms of the workings of the world and in terms of the structure of international politics and of economic relations, right? I'll take a few small sort of goes at your question. One of them is, you know, you mentioned the figure of Africa having had roughly 100 million people at the time of the height of the transatlantic slave trade. The first thing I think we need to understand is that the way Africa was hurt or hit or devastated by the processes we've spent most of our time here talking about, the extraction of the 12.5 million Africans who were delivered alive across the Atlantic, and then the death through a variety of processes of tens of millions of other Africans in the pursuit of that slave trade, imposed a tremendous demographic penalty on Africa, a demographic penalty on Africa that the continent is just now overcoming. It took all of this time until perhaps a decade or maybe 15 years ago, when Africa finally begins to achieve real demographic momentum in terms of the growth of its population, right? It took all of that time for Africa to get back to where it might have otherwise been in terms of demographic weight in the world. Ironically, in a kind of sad irony, many people now look at Africa's fast demographic growth and are panicking. They're worried about it, right? Like, oh no, so many Africans, what's it going to mean for the rest of the world? Like, this is necessarily a bad thing, right? Africa is actually just getting back to, demographically speaking, the path that it might have been on had there not been this tremendous demographic hit through the transatlantic slave trade. So that's one little piece. The second piece related to, again, from your question, is the organization and nature of the transatlantic slave trade was such that You know, Europeans didn't go galloping into African hinterlands, capturing slaves and putting them on ships. They used inducements to African polities through trade and luxury goods, for the most part, to encourage them to fight against each other, to sow instability and chaos, so that in the ensuing instability and chaos, there would be refugees, there would be war captives, there would be floating populations that could be easily roped into the slave trade.
Kind of a precursor to the divide and conquer strategies of the British Empire in India.
Correct. And on a truly vast scale, because this was, if you think of, you know, the zones of predation in the slave trade, we're talking from Senegal at the very western bulge of Africa, all the way around the circumference of the continent to, let's say, to Mozambique on the Indian Ocean coast. All of those areas were caught up in this, right? And so there's very interesting social science that I find persuasive, and I've cited in my book, that shows that there's a direct correlation between the intensity and duration of the slave trade and lack of social trust and political stability in Africa today. So the places where the slave trade was either most intense or of greatest duration are precisely the places in Africa that tend to be the least stable and have the greatest social problems. What the research shows is that this is a kind of deep and hidden, to the common person's understanding, legacy of the slave trade that is still with us today. Like, people who don't really spend a lot of time reading history or have just a superficial awareness of Africa's place in the world commonly ask the question, look, Africa's been independent. There's been independence all this time. Why are they still like that? Right? When I hear this question, and I've heard it a lot, it's not usually with some kind of malicious intent. It's an innocent but naive question, right? Well, there are reasons for this. And part of the reason is the long tail of this history, through social lack of social trust and heightened instability that grow out of these processes, right? There's one more thing that I would say, and this is something that I develop in my present book project much more, and that is, you said earlier in this conversation correctly that the places that are most affluent have, for the most part, been places that took off because, either directly or indirectly, because of the slave trade. That's true, right? Well, those patterns introduced structural realities in the global economy. You know, having a big head start in economic development in the 19th century or even earlier allowed people to make rules and to establish patterns of trade and to enforce a variety of extraction even beyond the traffic in enslaved human beings that continue to persist today in the world, right? And so Africa and all of the rest of the so-called developing world are constrained to living under these circumstances and have little power to undo the rules of the global system or to change the prevailing patterns of trade or political relations. You know, Africa, 54 countries, 17 or so of them landlocked. Being a landlocked country basically means being condemned to nothingness in perpetuity, right? No representation on the United Nations Security Council. Very few countries of any great geographic size or demographic weight. All of these things carry penalties forward in time that Africa has not found its way out of. And I invoked Africa's growing demographics because Africa is going to soon become such an important feature of global population, right? These are going to be global problems. In other words, the world is going to have to figure out ways to help Africa remedy these legacies in order not to do good for Africans, but in order to make the world a livable place for everyone.
And in a way, it's kind of an echo or reverberation of the global slave trade that we are seeing and will likely see more and more migration out of Africa, right? Very much because of these same imbalances that you describe. You know, you have countries in Western Europe where their demographics are going in absolutely the wrong direction. They don't have enough young people to work, while Africa has, you know, more than enough young people to work and yet doesn't have a lot of the economic resources. And so we may see kind of an aftershock in a way of this massive imbalance created by the global slave trade in our modern times.
Oh, I would say we will see. I don't think we need to be conditional about that. and the Europeans in the first instance, but everyone. This is a feature of American political life today. Anti-immigration politics in the United States share this common feature. The Europeans have this long tradition of thinking poorly of Africans that is a legacy of their enslavement and domination of Africa and of Africans, right? This is not just a crisis of Africa. The Europeans are going to have to overcome this in their own hearts and minds because the young people of the future in the world are predominantly going to be Africans. And if Europeans wish to continue to have prosperous lives, I wish them luck. I mean that very sincerely. If they wish to continue to have prosperous lives, they're going to have to overcome these categorical notions about Africans and indeed about Europeans. They're going to have to overcome the notion that to be European means to be white, right? And this will mean accepting Africans in their midst in a radically greater way than they are willing to accept thus far.
That's a fantastic point, and maybe one we can end on. And I would just say that, you know, history is so critical to the way we see the world now and the actions we think should be taken. And so having the wrong view of history, the wrong narrative, I think you can see it play out in many of the policies of the countries that we report on every day. So that's why I think your book is such an important one, including for our audience, for people who work on global development and humanitarian issues every day, to be really better acquainted with these points, which are not just some distant history, but are really extremely current and extremely relevant at this moment. It's a great book. It's a really ambitious book, beautifully written. Congratulations on it, and such a great pleasure to speak with you, Howard.
Terrific conversation, Raj. Thanks so much.
Howard French is a career foreign correspondent and global affairs writer, and the author of Born in Blackness, Africa, Africans, and the Making of the Modern World, 1471 to the Second World War. You can follow him on social media at H.O. French. The DevEx Book Club is produced by Lauren Evans. Our executive producer is Margaret Richardson, with assistance from Valeria del Castillo. Thank you all for joining. If you like the podcast, please share with your friends and give us 5 stars. And we really do want to hear from you. Please leave your thoughts in the comments or send me a message on Twitter at Raj_DevEx. To learn what we're reading next, make suggestions for future guests, or submit questions for authors, be sure to sign up for our DevEx Book Club mailing list, which you can find in the description of the show wherever you're listening to this. If you care about global development issues and you want the latest news, don't forget to subscribe to the DevEx Newswire at the link in the comments, where you'll get the day's top global development breaking news, analysis, and opinion, as well as the date of the next book club. Until then, do good out there, and thanks for joining.